This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Healthy Aging, providing you with the unique energy support of Pure NT Factor. NT Factor is the only nutritional formula clinically proven to reduce fatigue, whatever the cause, whether it be age, illness, or just being run down. NT Factor from Nutritional Therapeutics repairs damaged cells and restores healthy bacteria in your digestive tract. Clinical trials have shown NT Factor reduces fatigue by almost half, and it even reverses some symptoms of aging. I've been taking NT Factor for years with a 45-day money-back guarantee of nothing to lose. To order, call 800-982-9158. That's 800-982-9158. Or go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to discuss a subject I've been very much looking forward to sharing with you listeners. It has to do with a revolutionary diet plan that promises to help numerous sufferers of gastrointestinal ailments. We often talk about irritable bowel syndrome. That's an uncomfortable gastrointestinal condition. We talk about SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth, and it's important that we tackle these conditions with a diet. We've talked about gluten-free diets. Okay, that helps some patients, but according to research, the diet we're about to discuss with you has a very high rate of success in patients suffering from gastrointestinal problems. So today we're going to talk to an expert. She's Danielle Capolino. Danielle has extensive background in this field. She has worked with one of my favorite guests, Dr. Jerry Mullen, who is a pioneering integrative gastroenterologist. Subsequently, she has opened a practice here in New York and has written a great book called Healthy Gut, Flat Stomach. She's a registered dietitian. Provides nutritional counseling on digestive health. She's a graduate of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Wow. And the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. So Danielle, you're a rocket scientist engineer type, in terms of your background, huh?
Well, you know, I'm a neuroscientist, nutritionist type, I guess you could say.
Okay.
I do have a little bit of an unusual background.
Mm-hmm. But how did you? Yeah. So tell us a little bit about how you came to this. Was it through personal experience, personal interest? Did you suffer from a GI disorder that this approach helped you to overcome?
You know, everyone's surprised to hear that. No, I actually got into digestive health without having any of my own digestive health issues.
Okay.
But
I can say likewise, by the way. I'm intensely interested in it, but I knock wood. I'm knocking wood here.
Yeah, knock wood.
I got a pretty good knock gut. Wood. Yeah.
Of course, along this journey, I somehow did develop SIBO, but that is not what brought me here. So I did go to MIT as an undergrad, and I studied neuroscience, or as they call it, brain and cognitive science. And as an undergraduate, I got involved with doing research in the Wortmann Laboratory, which looked at serotonin, which, as you know, of course, but
yeah, I know the Wortmanns.
Many listeners know.
Yeah, the Wortmanns are very important figures from almost the beginning of when I began practicing nutritional medicine. They're big proponents of use of kind of manipulating neurotransmitters with diet and with amino acids. So tryptophan and 5-hydroxytryptophan and the serotonin feel-good connection and that whole thing. So that's a good
place
to start. Yeah.
So MIT in the past had a very strong nutrition program. They were sort of the last remaining part of that program when I was there. And so I got involved early on looking, doing research, you know, helping as a research assistant in studies that were using carbohydrates to affect your mood and weight loss, as you say. So we were looking at seasonal affective disorder, and we were looking at weight loss. And that was my first exposure to really seeing how diet can affect your health so dramatically. So that really left an imprint on me. And I spent some time at MIT doing other research after graduating, and I just felt like I had a calling to become an expert in a field. I was having some of my own health problems. They just weren't digestive, but I was having a lot of inflammatory issues, and I looked to nutrition to help me to figure that out, which led me to Johns Hopkins. And I think it was before my first day of class that I tracked down Jerry Mullen. And eventually that led to him allowing me very generously to shadow him during my dietetic internship. So I was able to spend a few months with him, with his patients, and with another dietitian. So I learned a tremendous amount about digestive health, and pretty early, it was probably my first day there, that I heard him talking about the low FODMAP diet.
And so, you know, let's clear up some terminology here. Some people refer to it as the FODMAPs diet. Some people refer to it as the FODMAP diet. But actually, the correct terminology is it's the low FODMAP diet. Okay? Right?
Correct. So that is correct, although I do interpret it that we're talking about the same thing when I hear any of those terms. The reason that the terminology that you said, low FODMAP diet, is absolutely correct is that all the foods that we're talking about are foods that contain FODMAPs. Now, let me take a second and define what a FODMAP is.
Okay.
So FODMAP stands for fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols.
Oh, that's a mouthful.
Which, it's a total mouthful. It doesn't help us understand what it means at all, unfortunately, but I just felt like we should get that out of the way. But what FODMAPs are in English is they're carbohydrates that don't look or taste like one another necessarily, but what they have in common is that they can be difficult to digest. And they're also, the F of FODMAP is important, the fermentable part. That means that bacteria like to eat them. And the other thing they have in common is that they can produce this whole slew of gastrointestinal distress that you mentioned.
In some ways, this is a little bit the successor to the Candida diet, the so-called Candida diet, the notion that certain foods fed Candida. Of course, Candida is just a fungus, and here we're talking about maybe fungus, but also bacterial proliferation when you, in effect, feed these bacteria. Perhaps there's some fungal species, Candida, yeast, and they turn your gut into a fermenting vat, you know, bubble, bubble, toil and trouble, like in the play Macbeth.
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly. That's a perfect analogy.
Okay. So and this is a modern concept that, when do you think this came along? Was there a discoverer of this, or did this kind of coalesce, you know, several streams of thought came together and they standardized it as the FODMAP diet?
Yeah, so this actually came about through a dietitian, actually, proud to say, at Monash University, which is in Australia. Her name is Sue Shepherd, and she was working on this as part of her dissertation. And along with Peter Gibson, and then subsequently many other dietitians and doctors based at Monash University, they have really been pioneers in doing the research, not only doing the research, but also spreading the research. They've done an incredible job. They have an app, they have a very active social media presence, and they've done a really good job in spreading the word. about this diet.
So let's get rid of some misconceptions here. This is not like a traditional allergy, you know, like somebody who says I'm allergic to dairy, or I'm allergic to eggs, I'm allergic to wheat. This is not about that. It's about the physical property of the food that it causes a secondary effect, that it causes the bacteria to go and produce a lot of gas and bloating.
Exactly. So as you say, this is not an allergy. These are potential food sensitivities. And the diet is almost a misnomer to call it a diet, I think, because it's really a tool to help you identify the particular foods that are causing these problems.
That's really an important distinction, I think, you know, what you just said, because a lot of people think, okay, that's a diet. You know, it's like, okay, lock and load, I'm going to follow the FODMAP diet, and, you know, without any interpretation, without any variance. And basically, it sounds like a tool to help you identify what you may be sensitive to. So each initial of the FODM and A and P, actually A is just an and, it's kind of like a drop-down menu. It's like, you know, let's look at the Fs, let's look at the Os, let's look at the Ds, the Ms, and the Ps. And underneath each of those, there may be a grouping of foods that you're sensitive to. So some people may be sensitive to, say, the F's and the P's, and others maybe the M's and the D's, right? And not you may not have to buy the whole thing, you know, embrace it fully to achieve some benefit.
Exactly. And I agree. I think it's a misconception, because sometimes patients will come to me and their doctor will have told them, oh, you should try the low FODMAP diet, and they'll come to me and say, oh, I've been on this for 6 months. Well, it's not designed to, you're not supposed to stay in the elimination phase of the diet indefinitely. Mm-hmm. It's really a temporary tool. In addition to being a tool, it's also something that, you know, you should try for a short term. I would say somewhere between 2 and 6 weeks, depending on what your symptoms are.
Mm-hmm. So before we get into the particulars here, who is a candidate for utilizing the FODMAP, the low FODMAP diet tool, to identify whether they're sensitive to certain foods? Who should consider it?
I would say anyone who has the diagnosis of irritable bowel syndrome, for sure. One sort of caveat I would say is you also have to be someone who's already eating FODMAPs. Mm-hmm. So even if you are someone who has IBS, if you take a look at what you're eating and none of the foods sort of resonate with you, then this probably is not the approach for you. But often people will take a look at the high FODMAP food list and say, oh, really? Mm-hmm. That could be a problem. And then that becomes more of a sign. So in addition to IBS, I would say there's a lot of overlap with irritable bowel on top of inflammatory bowel disease.
So like ulcerative colitis and Crohn's.
Exactly. So it can be helpful for those patients. It can be helpful with, even without a formal diagnosis of irritable bowel, I would say, which is people who have, you know, bloating and gas.
Mm-hmm. Hence the title "Healthy Gut, Flat Stomach," right? Because that's kind of a catchy title, and that's going to get people on the hook.
I wanted the book to be like you're having a conversation with a girlfriend, and I wanted it to be very approachable. And while the basis of the book is very much clinical, the way that I talk about it, I wanted it to be approachable.
Okay. And so there are various subtypes of irritable bowel syndrome. There's irritable bowel syndrome where you're constipated all the time. There's irritable bowel syndrome where it's kind of a mix. Sometimes you're constipated. Sometimes you have loose bowel movements. It's never quite right. And then there's one where it's, you know, called IBSD, which is a subtype where it's mostly urgency, loose bowel movements. You know, you can't go anywhere without thinking about where's the next bathroom. So of those types, is it helpful for all types, or is it more helpful for one type or another?
Yeah, it actually can be helpful for all types, which is pretty amazing. I would say that based on my experience, patients with IBS-C for constipation, based on the fact that constipation is just a slow, sluggish digestion in general, the diet can take a little bit longer to work for those patients.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then you mentioned SIBO. Let's talk a little bit about SIBO, or small intestine bacterial overgrowth. How might a low FODMAP diet impact that?
Well, a lot of, you know, the jury's still out on SIBO in terms of what the absolute best thing to do is. However, many of the doctors that I have worked with, including Dr. Mullen, recommend that you take a course of either antibiotics or herbal antimicrobials to treat SIBO. And then either in conjunction with the treatment to go on a low FODMAP diet, or immediately after the antimicrobial treatment to go on a low FODMAP diet.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be very effective.
And I will attest to that. And I have to say that I have many patients who we test for SIBO. We can actually do a breath test, and we can confirm that, or we can sometimes patients have symptoms and they don't have that. But when they have that, the treatment is an antibiotic, which is Xifaxan, which is pretty harmless, but is expensive, not up and covered by insurance. And my impression is that it often works, but only temporarily if you don't implement the diet.
Yeah.
And the same thing with herbs. The herbs I actually prefer to use, natural therapies. But again, the diet is such a major component of this that, you know, you can try and suppress the bad bugs, but if you feed them, they'll come roaring back. And, you know, how many different times can you take antibiotics? They're ineffective after a while. So the diet, I think, is a mainstay of treatment for SIBO.
That's really good to hear. Can I ask you, do you recommend that patients start the diet while they're on the antimicrobial therapy or after they have finished?
Yeah, that's a good question, but I think it doesn't matter. You know, if you want faster relief, you can I guess the only problem with starting it while you're taking the antibiotic is that if you're conducting a little experiment, like, you know, is it the antibiotic effective or is the diet more effective? It's going to be less clear. But many patients are just, they want the fastest possible route to relief and they don't care whether it's the antibiotic or the diet.
Yeah.
Actually, what I'll generally do is I'll stack the diet ahead of treatment. I'll say, try the diet, and that'll make it less likely that they may require an expensive antibiotic or, you know, a program of herbs. But, you know.
Yeah. Because I know there's different schools of thought on this. So that, I was wondering, there's a Dr. Pimentel in Los Angeles.
On the West Coast,
very big advocates. I know there's like an East Coast and West Coast SIBO approach. And on the West Coast, they seem to be very much in favor of adding some FODMAPs into your diet during the antimicrobial treatment, based on the idea that you're still, you want to be feeding the bacteria a little bit so that you can kill it more effectively.
Oh, that's an interesting idea. That's an interesting idea, because I guess what they're saying there is it's similar to, you know, one idea I have about cancer is like, okay, if you go on this wonderful, terrific anti-cancer diet while you're getting chemo or radiation, they may be less effective because in effect you're halting the growth of the cancer cells. When they grow or proliferate, they're more vulnerable to the effects of the chemo radiation. So yeah, that point may be well taken.
They're trying to starve the bacteria and kill the bacteria at the same time might not be as effective.
No, that's an interesting wrinkle to that therapeutic approach. Obviously the low FODMAP diet can be a really helpful adjunct to the treatment of SIBO, IBS, or just, you know, without getting too fancy about a medical diagnosis, how prevalent is bloating? I mean, you say, this is like talking to a girlfriend. You have to say, when women get together and talk and share, bloating is a major complaint. I think a lot of men, they're less attuned to that. But that's a big issue for women, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I did not mean to say that men do not suffer from this problem. It's extremely common. I mean, even if you just look at general IBS, the numbers can be as high as 1 in 5, depending on what you read. So the number of people who just get bloated, I think it's probably almost everyone.
Yeah, universal. It's universal. And, you know, I think that this is a very reasonable approach, whether or not you have a diagnosed medical problem like IBS, SIBO, colitis. You know, those are more heavy-duty conditions. But if you're symptomatic, it's worth trying. Okay, so, you know, we've established that it's not a diet that's like a lifetime commitment. It's merely a tool to identify your personal triggers. We've set the stage for a discussion of the FODMAP diet. The book is Healthy Gut, Flat Stomach. Daniel Cappellino is the author we're talking to. And when we return, we're going to drill down. We're going to talk about the components. What's the F? What's the O? What's the D? What's the M? And what's the P? And when you eliminate all those things, what's left? You know, are you going to starve on this diet? And I think that's the point of this book, is that it's a very user-friendly implementation plan that won't put you into starvation or deprivation when you go on the diet. By the way, do you have a website, Danielle? Is that a resource we can share with our listeners?
I do, yes. It's DanielleCappellino.com.
Okay, and
shall I spell it?
Yeah, it's pretty phonetic, but go ahead.
It's Danielle, DanielleCappellino, Cappellino, CAPALINO.com.
Okay, good. So there, what will people find there when they go to that resource?
You will find, in addition to information about the book, you can find out how to work with me. So I have a blog. You can look at my latest posts. I try to give some low FODMAP information and recipes and just more information about how we can work together.
Good. Okay. So in part two, we'll focus on, you know, what are the culprit foods, the triggers that are eliminated in the low FODMAP diet, the so-called high FODMAP foods. And we'll talk about what a low FODMAP diet looks like, what can you eat, and we'll share about some more additional resources for low FODMAP dieters. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.